This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After reporting on the Taliban regime, my guest Pamela Constable is covering the attempts to build a democracy in Afghanistan. In April, she was embedded with a Marine regiment in Fallujah. She's covered Southeast Asia for The Washington Post since 1999. She's also covered conflicts and natural disasters around the world, including Chile, El Salvador, India, and Pakistan. In her new memoir, Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia, she admits that she's lived an extraordinary life, but she also reflects on the costs of that life, the things she has not had, like a real home and family. Constable is in the U.S. for a few weeks before returning to Afghanistan. We spoke yesterday. As you see that there have been more beheadings, what goes through your mind? Do you feel like you're in, that you've gone back in time to another century when these things were common?
It's a particularly gruesome and barbaric kind of behavior. It's calculated to send, you know, a very, very strong message of real hatred and vengeance. It's funny that you should think about, mention going back in time. I mean, I live in Afghanistan, a country where barbaric forms of behavior towards one's enemies have been practiced up until very, very recently, including the Civil War. And after the Civil War, you had a regime in place that used barbaric methods of punishment, including executions and stonings and amputation of limbs. So this is something I've actually been working in an environment of for a number of years. And obviously it's a terrible thing, and it's strange to most people. But at least in Afghanistan, which is struggling to begin a very fledgling democracy from basically zero, you know, there's a whole legacy of violence and vengeful retaliatory violence that the country is trying to overcome even as we speak.
Are you the one who seems strange in an environment like that, strange for not comprehending that chopping off an arm is a just punishment?
Well, I should distinguish between, you know, past and present a little bit. I worked in Afghanistan a number of times during the Taliban regime. I was there 10 times. And yes, I felt extremely strange, you know, for a variety of reasons. One, being a woman on the street, which was absolutely unheard of. Often you'd walk down the street and you wouldn't see a single Westerner, let alone another woman. And then being a journalist was very strange there because there weren't any. So for a whole variety of reasons, and not to mention being, you know, Christian in an extreme Islamic regime, I always felt very odd. And I tried my best to sort of fit in or make gestures or pretend. I always wore very, very baggy clothing, for example. We were not required to cover our faces because, you know, only Muslim women were required to cover their faces, but we did have to cover everything else as shapelessly as possible. So, you know, I did try hard, but, you know, automatically everybody who saw me knew that I was a complete oddity, and I would just have to forge ahead and try to do my job.
In your book, you mentioned that in Kabul, there were, and I can't remember whether this is during the Taliban regime or after that, that there were very few public restrooms in all of Kabul and only two in all of Kabul for women. Was that before or after during or after the Taliban?
That was during the Taliban. Since then, many, many hotels or restaurants and public accommodations have been built, and it's completely different on that score. But there were a number of times in Kabul before the Taliban fell where, you know, you really had to plan your whole day around whether you'd be able to get to a certain restaurant, the only restaurant that actually allowed women inside and even had a bathroom for them as well. And even now, if you're crossing the desert or you're crossing, you know, a long road, I mean, there are very, very few bathrooms throughout this very rural and poor society. So one becomes quite shameless at and adept at adjusting to that situation.
Well, that's such a great paradox. I mean, you mentioned that you would kind of find a hidden place in the ruins in Kabul, but, you know, it's such a paradoxical situation because it's the whole sense of modesty that forbids women to be in the street or forbade women from being in the street, and that, you know, accounted for the lack of restrooms. And it kind of forces you to behave in a very shameless way.
That's true. Although, for better or worse, yeah. The Taliban always treated us like honorary men when we were there.
Mm-hmm. Who are the greatest security threats coming from now, and just like regular safety threats? Is it from terrorists, from former warlords, private militias, common criminals?
There's not a huge amount of common crime. Basically, the two other sources you mentioned, you have these revived Taliban fighting forces and various allies and extremist groups that operate along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is a very difficult, rugged, porous area, very hard to patrol or control. And they primarily attack individuals, aid workers, others in rural areas of the south and southeast. You have an entirely different problem in the north and west, where you have other militias which are allegedly allied with the government and allied with Western interests, but who are trying to make sure they keep a grip on the kind of power they've had over their regions for a very long time. So their threat is more of intimidation and abuse, extortion, putting pressure on the populace, vendettas and feuds, whereas the threat from the revived Taliban in the south and their allies is really more of a serious terrorist threat. So the situation is quite serious, but I should add that it's limited to certain areas. They certainly do not control the country or even a large part of it.
Afghanistan is preparing for an election. Are the former warlords cooperating with the elections, and are they negotiating for power in return for cooperation?
Well, that's what's been happening with some of the big ones. When I was last in Afghanistan several weeks ago, there had just been this round of talks, very controversial round of talks between the president and some of his emissaries and some of these big militia leaders. And they had reportedly agreed that they would not field a unified candidate against him. But that has been a very controversial development because, you know, there are sort of two versions of history in the Afghan public's mind. There is the version of history that is put forth by the militia leaders that, you know, we were great warriors, we helped the world defeat the Soviet Union, we brought them down with our Stinger missiles, and we deserve, you know, an honored, revered place in history forever and ever, not to mention a nice share of power and money. The other version of history is that these same people were responsible for this vicious civil war that destroyed Kabul and displaced many, many people, killed many, many people in Afghanistan during the early 1990s. And that's the way they're remembered by many people who think they should have no part in public life, no role, no honored place at all. Karzai has continually said he believes in the bringing them inside the tent philosophy, better than having them outside the tent shooting in. And that's the way he's approached it. But it has been a very criticized approach.
Would you say that there's truth in both of those historical readings?
I would. I mean, these were America's heroes in the 80s. You know, they were the rugged mujahideen who fought with plastic sandals and in freezing cold, wearing cotton robes and up in the mountains, and, you know, shot down Russian helicopters. And you know, they were the heroes of the Reagan era. It was just astonishing to see these same people, you know, completely change their spots and to see what happened after the Russians left. And you had basically sort of chaos and mayhem and horrendous conflict among these militia leaders that they literally destroyed the capital of Kabul. I mean, until very recently, there's been a lot of building in Kabul in the last year and a half. But for the first year after the Taliban left, you could drive through Kabul and it literally looked like Dresden. It looked like, you know, Warsaw. It looked like a city after World War II that had not changed at all. It's the strangest, surreal, most place to live. Now it's gotten much more bustling and lively. There's money coming in. There's internet cafes. There's cell phone shops. It's very quickly catching up with the world, which is exciting to see. Although it's a pain in the neck, since now you can't get across the street without being hit by a taxi. But that's better than having no taxis at all.
You've lived an extraordinary life covering trouble spots around the world. India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Cuba, Chile. You write in your book about traveling around the world. You also write in your book about the costs of this extraordinary life that you've led. What are some of the costs?
Well, the main cost, that really prompted me in many ways to write the book, was I realized that in traveling, you know, so far and wide to sort of find all these exotic places and cover these strife and turmoil and come to grips with the struggles of distant peoples and societies, that I really had neglected my own family, my own friends, my own life. I missed, you know, every family wedding, every family funeral. You know, I regret that. I mean, obviously the other big issue was, you know, having children. I never had children, and that's because I was on the move and I wanted to keep going and I wanted to be sharp and fresh and mobile and agile and all those things that a journalist needs to be. And I really was afraid of losing that.
Well, it seems to me, though, that from moment to moment, you probably didn't want that more secure, anchored life of home, family, children, with all the responsibilities as well as all of the pleasures that one gets from that life.
Well, that's right. As I said, I was always sort of on the move. I mean, I've been through periods of time. I have been married in the past. I have had houses in the past. I've had sort of semblances or periods of normality in my life. But it never lasted in the sense that I always wanted to go off and do something else. I was never really ready to settle down within myself. Was never really ready to settle down. And I always felt like, I don't know, I felt as if I could, the places I was needed or the places I could do something of value were not home. And I'm still not convinced that that was a right decision. But as I say, I don't regret it. And I do think and hope I have added something of value. You know, I have a part in the book where I talk about, I have a very, very close friend, and, you know, while I was off in some horrible place, she was having a baby. And so there's a parallel there. You know, she stays up at dawn with a colic and I'm up at dawn because I'm trying to catch a plane. You know, we've had these sort of parallel, but very, very different experiences. And it's something we talk about often.
You also have a friend, Elizabeth Newfer, who was killed in Iraq, shortly after the, official fighting ended, and she was killed in a car accident on the highway. She wasn't driving. She had a driver then. She reported for the Boston Globe. It sounds like you were pretty close and that you used to compare notes a lot because you led similar lives. You were similar in age. You were close in age. How did her death affect your view of the decisions you made in your life and the dangers that you were continuing to expose yourself to?
It affected me a lot. You know, when she died, I had already finished my book, and it really made me think a lot and feel a lot. And I ended up rewriting the entire epilogue of the book about her and to reflect on even more on some of the choices I had made and she had made. And you know, we understood each other's compulsions and each other's sort of idealism and what it was that drove us to do these difficult assignments and to be far from the people we cared about who cared about us. You know, I sat down to write the book partly because I was in an incident where four of my colleagues were killed in Afghanistan in 2001. So that sort of theme of it could have been me really runs through the book and runs through a lot of what I've been thinking about in the past several years. I've known a number of people who've been killed now, some close, some acquaintances, some not people I knew at all, but people I'd met once, who've been killed in covering or being a part of the conflict that I've been working on for the past number of years. And it adds up, that feeling of horror adds up, and that feeling of, you know, is it worth taking that risk also adds up. And I think Elizabeth's death brought it probably closer to home than any other that I had experienced.
How were your four colleagues killed in Afghanistan?
We were driving in a convoy. The Taliban had just fallen, and we were all driving in a convoy. We had come across the border from Pakistan after a great deal of difficulty, and we were driving toward Kabul in a convoy of, I don't know, eight vehicles or something. But it was a sort of a spread-out convoy. It wasn't like a military convoy. We couldn't really necessarily see the next car. And this was in just around Thanksgiving of 2001. All of a sudden, we saw this cloud of dust, and this taxi in front of us was spinning around and came back towards us, racing towards us. And we looked, and there was the driver, and there was no one in the car. And the driver was screaming at us to follow him. So we all turned around and followed him. And we finally got to a gas station and stopped, and he was crying, and he was hysterically trying to explain what had happened in the Pashto dialect. And gunmen, possibly Taliban, renegade Taliban, had flagged down the taxi at gunpoint, had pulled out the two passengers, and had shot them dead. And this happened with a second taxi that was following it. And they were just too far ahead for us to see when it happened. But it was, you know, that was awful. And one of the people who was killed was someone I knew quite well, from Pakistan. And it turned out I was the only person in this whole group that knew him. And so I had to identify his body in the morgue the next day. And that really was shocking, because he was a very jovial, sort of wisecracking, cheerful guy, a photographer from Reuters. And I'd known him. And the night before, we were sitting in our hotel cracking jokes, and he was helping me with my computer, and we were laughing. And I saw him in the morgue. He just looked like a piece of stone. He didn't look like a human being at all. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, maybe 100 yards closer, 100 yards further down the road, and this would be me.
Did you write about this for the Washington Post?
I did. I wrote a piece for the Outlook section, which was in fact the genesis of this book, and it is the prologue of the book as well.
So you were able to write in a first-person kind of way about the experience.
I did, but it was very difficult. They kept sending back the piece and saying, we want more of you, we want more of you.
Really, because it's interesting. I guess it's because it's the Outlook, the magazine part, you know, as opposed to, because in the news section, they might be saying, we want less of you.
Well, in the news section, I was very careful. In fact, in my book, I describe that whole incident, you know, and I describe sitting down to write the story, and I couldn't even type the words. You know, it was so dispassionate and so objective and so removed. I didn't feel like anything, it didn't feel like me at all. And that's why I was very glad I had the chance to actually sit down and write something for Outlook a week later, because I was able to actually say a bit more about how it affected me and the rest of us. There were 40 of us in that hotel when this happened, and it was, you know, sort of sent this incredible chill through the whole press corps.
Now, your book ends with you being summoned by your paper to go to Iraq, and before you go, you call a contractor and ask the contractor, who's a friend of yours, a carpenter, to build an addition to your cottage that you live in, with a reading nook and a music den, kind of like preparing to have more of a stable physical home to return to. What's the status of that now?
I spent my first night there last Saturday. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I've kept the house all along. I've had friends staying there. I've had a menagerie staying there. I'm always bringing stray dogs and cats back, and people keep taking care of them for me. But it was just really nice. I do feel more solid. I feel like I've really, you know, I've been on the road for so long, and my life has been in boxes for so long that it just feels really nice to maybe put down a few roots and spend a little time in my garden and unpack a few of my mementos that most people keep on their coffee tables. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with your work and your life.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Pamela Constable covers South Asia for The Washington Post. Her new memoir is called Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia.